California Dreaming is a true crime podcast launched in 2017 that delves into the dark side of the Golden State and sometimes beyond. Born and raised in California, I not only cover the crimes that have fascinated me over the years, but the ones that have fascinated you as well. With a backlog of hundreds of episodes and bonuses and dozens more on Patreon, you'll have countless hours to binge. And with soothing music and a unique, quiet intensity, you might just be lulled to sleep. Almost every episode is over an hour long, ad-free, with no loud bursts of music or audio clips. California Dreaming is available on all your favorite directories, so hit subscribe and give it a try. It just might be your new go-to bedtime podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Today is part two of the Zendik Arts Farm. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest you do so before diving into this episode. Today, I'll be starting where we left off on the FAQ, and this episode includes audio from Helen reading her excerpts from her book, Mating in Captivity, as well as, at the end of the episode, 30 minutes of Wolf Zendik talking to the Zendik community. So, let's get started. Today we start with language. I've noticed that the Zendiks do a hell of a lot of swearing. I've never heard fuck and shit so constantly and creatively used to do so many different grammatical tasks. What's up with that? Cult members strive to imitate their leaders. Errol has a notoriously foul mouth, part of her off-the-cuff communication style, especially when she's angry. Also, it's in Errol's interest that her followers should speak as crudely as she does, since the constant swearing obviates the need for precise articulation and thereby helps curtail critical thinking. For example, if someone asks, "How are you doing?" and you respond, "I'm fucked up," or "I feel like shit," you don't have to search for appropriate descriptors of what exactly is bothering you or what's causing you to feel as you do. The use of loaded language, for example, jargon words and phrases, also functions as a thought-stopping mechanism. Can you give examples of Zendik jargon and explain what they mean? Sure, I'd love to. Here's a lexicon of Zendik speak. Square means conventional or normal. Anything not created at or consonant with Zendik. Cheese, a behavior, a relationship. These can all be labeled or denounced as square. Get into your life means forget about your failed love affair or whatever else is bugging you and get back to work. Being affirmative means vanquishing negativity. For example, critical thoughts about your current situation or about Zendik, and again, getting back to work. Take the bus home is the worst threat, short of leave the farm, that can be leveled against a Zendik seller. It means you're being such a drag on the street that your crew would be better off if you just took a bus back to the farm, in disgrace, to face an uncertain fate. Get an apartment is the relationship equivalent of take the bus home. It means that your love affair is so square, so dissonant with Zendik philosophy, that the farm would be better off if you left and conducted it in the death culture. Running your own show is bad. It means wanting or attempting to complete a task in your own way or by yourself. It can also mean initiating a project of your own without permission. Hanging in means staying at Zendik no matter what. No matter how much input you're getting, no matter how miserable you feel, supposedly everyone who hangs in will eventually achieve enlightenment. Input means criticism, generally not of the constructive kind. It tends to induce shame and humiliation in the person being criticized. Box means vagina. Cock is the favored designation for penis. Balling means having sex. Making it also means having sex. On means aware, alert, making money. Out of it means unaware, upset, fucked up, sad, depressed, preoccupied, not making money. Out means a period of time spent away from the farm. While an out may be acknowledged as necessary in hindsight, as a means of mowing down fantasies that were keeping the person from committing to Zendik, the need to take one is usually condemned as a sign of weakness, even betrayal. To escape is to engage in an activity you shouldn't enjoy but do, thanks to your corrupt upbringing in the death culture, such as watching a movie, listening to square music, etc. The purpose of escaping is to take the edge off so you can return, refreshed, to your revolutionary lifestyle. Survival is any activity Errol deems necessary, hence flub-ups as diverse as crashing a car, making too little money on a sailing trip, or failing to answer the phone. It can all be condemned under the heading, fucking with survival. A warrior is anyone who lives at Zendik and is battling to save the planet Earth from the spoilers or normals. All others are civilians. Getting ego-jacked means feeling good about something you personally have accomplished. You should be accused of this. You will almost certainly be prohibited from continuing to pursue the activity in question. Now we move on to money and resources. Who owns the Zendik property? Errol owns Zendik Farm. Fawn will inherit the farm when Errol dies. How do the Zendik support themselves? They sell their magazines, CDs, t-shirts, bumper stickers, and novel, yes, that's novel, singular, on the street, at concerts and rallies, and on their website. They telemarket t-shirts and sometimes bumper stickers to stores all over the U.S., often neglecting to tell the buyer that both items feature their website, always neglecting to explain precisely what kind of operation the t-shirt sales are supporting. They appropriate whatever funds members have access to, such as grants, inheritances, savings, college funds. They've also taken out 2 mortgages on the property, and they juggle many credit cards. If you leave and they possess a credit card in your name, they may well continue to use it. They'll stop when you sic your lawyer on them, but not before. They also get a huge de facto donation every year from the American public. As an educational nonprofit, they don't pay taxes. Wait, Zendik is a nonprofit? How does that work? It doesn't. Here's what the IRS has to say about charities and nonprofits. To be tax exempt under Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code, an organization must be organized and operated exclusively for exempt purposes set forth in Section 501(c)(3), and none of its earnings may inure to any private shareholder or individual. A Section 501(c)(3) organization must not be organized or operated for the benefit of private interests such as the creator or creator's family, shareholders of the organization, other designated individuals, or persons controlled directly or indirectly by such private interests. Zendik is in fact, quote, organized and operated solely for the benefit of private interests. For example, Errol, the creator, and her family. The Zendik Farm Arts Foundation is a fiction. A more appropriate official designation for Zendik would be the Wolfing Family Trust Fund. What happens if I inherit money while I'm living at Zendik? If you're Errol and your father dies and you inherit $60,000, you call a meeting and let the rank and file know that they better not plan on taking a vacation anytime soon, because this money is yours to spend as you please. Maybe you'll use it to buy a diamond ring or some other luxury item you've always wanted. If you're not Errol and you inherit money, you better give up the goods pronto. You might use a fraction of the money to buy a newer, better version of some piece of equipment you use frequently, say a video camera, and donate the rest outright. Needless to say, you will not be taking the video camera with you should you ever leave. What happens if I'm receiving SSI or some other form of unearned monthly income while living at Zendik? You will be hounded periodically to arrange your finances such that all your money goes straight to Errol. You will be told that your having an alternate means of support is preventing you from fully committing to Zendik, hence stunting your evolution. What happens if I bring a vehicle with me to the farm? You sign it over to Zendik, and it gets named after you. If you don't do this fairly quickly, you will be issued an ultimatum. Give Errol your wheels or drive away on them. If, as a Zendik, I want or need something beyond basic food and toiletries, a new toothbrush, say, or a pair of socks, how do I go about getting it? Well, if you're Errol or Fawn, you get in your car, drive to town, and buy it. Or you get out your credit card, get on the internet, and buy it. If you're one of the rank and file, you put it on the shopping list. If you're lucky, Fawn will decide your request is legitimate, and it will be filled on the next shopping trip. If not, tough. AnnaLouisa.com has sustainable jewelry that you or someone you know will absolutely love. It's usually hard for me to find a style of jewelry that I like. Anna Luisa changed that for me. I found pieces that are actually my style, which I would call boho, but that's definitely not the only style they have. There are an array of styles. You can have fun with this jewelry as well by stacking pieces together and mixing and matching. Their jewelry is super versatile and can be worn with anything in your closet, from t-shirts and loungewear to dresses and pantsuits and everything in between. The jewelry at Anna Luisa is high-quality jewelry that is also environmentally friendly. Everything is priced affordably, they use recycled materials whenever possible, and their pieces are 100% carbon and water neutral, because the choices we make really do matter. Go browse their stunning pieces at Anna Luisa, which is AnnaLuisa. Get a discount when you go to shop.annaluisa.com/truecrime. That's shop.annaluisa.com/truecrime. Discount code TRUECRIME. When long-term members leave, do they receive a share of the group's asset or any kind of allowance to assist them as they reintegrate into the outside world? Members who leave do not receive a share of the group's assets, no matter what they have done to help accrue those assets. One member who had donated a couple $100,000 to Zendik was given a failing minivan as a going-away gift. Other members have received one-way bus tickets. I gave the farm $13,000. Just before I was dropped off at the highway, I asked one of the other members if I could have some money. The person asked me, "What do you need money for?" "Food," I said. The person grudgingly went to Errol and got me $10. Now we move on to names. What's up with the weird names? When Larry Wolfing and Carol Weinberg Merson Wolfing became revolutionaries back in the 60s, they struck their first blow at the establishment by changing their names to Wolf Zendik and Errol Wolf. Nowadays, Errol goes by Errol Wolf, Errol Wolfing, or Errol Zendik. Zendiks believe that adopting a new name helps you transcend your corrupt ancestry and upbringing. Now, populations and demographics. Why are there so few Zendiks? It seems like the population of the farm just keeps shrinking and shrinking. Yes, Zendik's numbers have been shrinking steadily for some time now. In winter of 1999, there were almost 70 people living at the farm. Now there are 23. The population has decreased by two-thirds in the past 8 years. I divide this exodus into two main stages, North Carolina and West Virginia. Between 1999, the year that Wolf died, and 2004, the year the farm moved from North Carolina to West Virginia, about 35 people, or half the 1999 peak population, departed Zendik. During this period, Errol was consolidating her power. She was purging old-timers whom she feared might challenge her. She was also asserting direct control over the rank and file. Previously, she had controlled them indirectly, through her inner circle. Rather than sending surrogates to give input, or simply trusting her inner circle to keep those below them in line, as per her desires, she began to criticize each member personally. This change in dictatorial style made it difficult to remain at Zendik unless you were truly dedicated. It became harder and harder to fly under the radar, that is, escape frequent public humiliation, by working hard and keeping quiet. There was, however, still a spatial escape valve. Also, as long as the farm was in North Carolina, the fact that the population was spread out in 7 separate houses at least made it possible to hide out in your room occasionally to retreat from Errol's rule while you were sleeping. This escape valve was shut off when all 35 Zendiks moved into one big mansion on 227 acres in West Virginia. There, Errol's presence became pervasive. Even temporary respite was no longer an option. In the year or so after the move, another 10 people left, bringing the population down to about 25, and no new recruits arrived to replace them. The farm in West Virginia is much harder to get to. You don't show up there unless you're hell-bent on checking out Zendik. Also, the few visitors who do show up tend not to receive much attention, since many Zendiks would rather play World of Warcraft than welcome newcomers. Finally, the abundance of negative internet commentary on Zendik has made it far easier for potential visitors to get an advance inkling of what they might be getting themselves into. The last arrival to stay and become a committed member moved in about 5 years ago. As of July 2008, after 3 births, a few more departures, and the return of a former member, the population stands at 23. Now, just for fun, I'm going to do a demographic analysis of the current crop of Zendiks to see what it can teach us about Zendik's narrowing appeal. Of the 23 current Zendiks, 8 either were born at the farm or helped start it. For example, they're either exploiting the cult arrangement, which is Errol, or had no choice about joining. Only 15 are adults who chose to move there. Of these 15 adults, 5 are men who are or have been Errol's or Fawn's boyfriend. 3 of these 5 have had children with Fawn, and 4 are women with children born at Zendik. So the farm is home to only 6 adults who were not born there, don't have children born there, and have no past or current romantic involvement with Errol or Fawn. I suspect Errol keeps these 6 around primarily for their money-making capabilities. At least 5 of them are accomplished sellers. More and more, Zendik is becoming a place where only those with blood, or at least fluid exchange ties to the monarch, survive. Now let's talk psychic phenomena. What's the Zendik model of casualty? How do they explain what happens in the world around them? The Zendiks believe in something called a psychic cause and effect, otherwise known elsewhere in the New Age as the secret, or the law of attraction. According to the law of psychic cause and effect, everything that happens to you results from a conscious or subconscious desire on your part. To quote Wolf, quote, "You attract to yourself what you are." So, if you vibe into getting popped while you're selling, you subconsciously wanted to be reprimanded by a daddy figure, or you subconsciously wanted to quit selling, or you subconsciously wanted to fuck with survival. According to Errol, everyone who died on 9/11, terrorists, building occupants, airplane passengers, was participating in a vast psychic conspiracy. That is, subconsciously arranging their own deaths. According to Zendik, every one of those people wanted to die. You'll notice that both examples I've given to illustrate psychic cause and effect involve negative events. There's a reason for this. When bad things happen at Zendik, they're attributed to the individual's bad vibe or bad philosophy. When good things happen, they're generally attributed to the righteousness of the group and the cause. Now we move on to selling. When I give money to a Zendik seller, where does it go? What is it used for? It goes straight to Errol or Fawn. At the end of every selling trip, one seller bears the bag of cash, like a sacred offering, to the royal chambers. Thereafter, it is used to buy food, toiletries, building supplies, animal feed, electricity, phone service, blank t-shirts, and so on. It is also used for mortgage and credit card payments, and for whatever else Errol and Fawn feel like buying, for themselves and Fawn's children. Those who make the money have no say in how it's spent. Do Zendik sellers have quotas? For example, is each seller required to make a certain amount of money every time she or he goes out? No, there's no articulated quota. However, there is a general understanding of what kind of take is respectable and what kind of take isn't. When I first moved to the farm in 1999, $200 per person per day was respectable for an average street scene. By the time I left in 2004, $300 was the respectable, and anything less was likely to win you a nice chunk of input. I'm guessing that the bar is resting at about $400 nowadays. Also, what's considered good enough varies from scene to scene and is determined in part by how the rest of your crew does. If you make $300 at Ozfest and every other seller makes $600, you're going to have some explaining to do. What scenes and events are most lucrative for Zendik sellers? It used to be that Ozfest and large music events were Zendik's biggest money makers. Nowadays, thanks to the popularity of the Stop Bitching, Start a Revolution rallies and protests, have superseded concerts and festivals. At the March for Women's Lives in April of 2004, 14 sellers averaged $1,000 each. The record for the largest take by a single seller in a single day, $3,000, was set more recently at another rally. What's an average selling day like? You rise at 7 or 8 after sleeping sardine style on the floor of a stranger's house or apartment for about 4 or 5 hours. You shower, cook, and pack food and ice coolers. Clean and organize the van. Load selling bags. You drive to your selling spot. You start selling sometime between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. If it's freezing cold, you keep selling. If it's scorching hot, you keep selling. If it's raining, you keep selling. If you're exhausted and miserable, you read an affirmative life quote, tell yourself it's all attitude, and keep selling. You sell till midnight, or 1, or 2, or 3, depending on the scene, depending on when the last drunken barfly or concert goer staggers to her or his car. Then you get in the van, count your money, and hand it over to whoever's in charge of the cash bag for the trip. If you've done well, you go to bed exhausted, but relatively calm, unless you've been accused of getting an ego jack from your success. If you've done badly, you go to bed exhausted and terrified, praying may morning never come. Because when morning does come, your crew will accuse you of some psychic crime or other. You will grovel, beat your breast, plead guilty, and wait anxiously for further input from Errol or Fawn as a senior member of your crew makes the obligatory phone call home. You will spend the next selling day attempting to redeem yourself, so you can at least return to the farm feeling like you haven't lost your right to belong to the human family. You may or may not succeed. Now we come to sex and relationships. Do the Zendiks have orgies? They may have had orgies in the past, but they didn't when I was there, and so far as I know, they don't now. Damn, that's disappointing. I thought they were hippies. Do they at least practice free love? Supervised love is a better term for it. Any two people wishing to have a date, that is, repaired to designated date space to have sex, must first inform the group of their plans. The group may or may not approve. Afterwards, the couple may be required to communicate the details of encounter to the group. Zendiks believe that couples who keep their sex lives to themselves are condemned to implode, go square, succumb to their conditioned corruption. You mean Errol has to ask the group's permission every time she wants to have sex with Revel? No, Errol and Fawn are exempt from the requirements to communicate with the group about their sex lives. In my 5 years at the farm, Fawn had 2 dates with men who were not her main squeeze. After those dates, she publicly assessed their respective performances, focusing on their shortcomings. The two men were not asked and did not volunteer their opinion of her sexual prowess. Otherwise, neither she nor Errol ever discussed their sex life in public. What's the tenor of these discussions about sex? Are they friendly and supportive? At times, they can be supportive. It's possible that the group might provide a troubled individual or couple with a way to go. However, in most instances, discussions of people's sexuality, which tend to be crude, profane, and graphic, leave them shamed and humiliated, and act as launching pads for attack. For example, articulation of a particular aspect of a member's sexual corruption balloons into a more generalized condemnation of the person. While, so far as I know, children do not generally attend sex meetings, they're not shielded from these conversations, which can occur at any time in any context. Wait a minute, sex meetings? What are those? Those are gatherings at which members bring up their sexual problems in order to get help or criticism from the group. In my experience, Fawn and Zoe usually officiated and dispensed the lion's share of advice. What qualifies them to act as sexual counselors? According to the Zendiks, Fawn is sexually enlightened because she was raised by Wolf and Errol, who were sexually enlightened. Zoe gleans his sexual cachet from the fact that he was Fawn's first serious boyfriend and fathered her first child. Before joining Zendik, he was a gang member in LA. Neither of them has a degree or any kind of training in counseling. Do Zendiks practice birth control? Yes, they use the rhythm method. That is, they attempt to time sexual intercourse when the woman is not fertile. This means that before every date, the woman must get specced. For example, allow another woman to examine her OS using a speculum and check the texture of her vaginal mucus. The woman who does the specking then decides on the basis of this evidence whether the woman having the date can have intercourse without a condom, with a condom, or not at all. Who decides whether an unintended pregnancy or any pregnancy will be terminated at Zendik? Errol sets the perimeters of the abortion discussion. In some cases, Errol has told the woman it's entirely up to her. In other cases, Errol has demanded that the woman have an abortion, even though she didn't want to. Do new members get tested for STDs before having sex at Zendik? Yes, they get tested for all the standard STDs, except HIV. According to the Zendiks, neither AIDS nor the HIV virus exists. How do the Zendiks feel about homosexuality? The Zendiks believe that homosexuality is unnatural. While homosexual desires may be worth indulging as a fantasy, a thing to get out of one's system, it's not an appropriate orientation for a mature human being. An individual may reach completion under the terms of the proto-neutronic principle only by forming a union with a member of the opposite sex. There's a chapter titled The F-Word Slur in Wolfe's novel A Quest Among the Bewildered. Wolf details his pity for those who never get back to vagina. Quote, "Sometimes the gayness seems like sadness, and of course the very fact of their homosexuality is a vaginal denial. Denying the vagina. You deny your source, and thereby yourself. And into this impossible paradox, any fairly adjusted overt homo has twisted the frame of his days." End quote. Now we move on to the cult questions. Is Zendik really a cult? Yes, cult is the pattern that best describes Zendik. It is not a new religion. Zendiks venerate their human leader, not God or a set of principles, an artist commune which Errol alone controls money, land, resources. Most members are discouraged from developing personal artistic interests, or activist group. They do nothing concrete to preserve the ecology, nor do they join with or support other groups who are doing something. Okay, so how do you define a cult? My working soundbite definition of a cult is this: a group of people enthralled to a leader who uses fear, false hope, and magical thinking to exploit and control them. Robert J. Lifton and Margaret Thaler Singer, both psychologists and students of thought reform, have composed lists of characteristics common to destructive cults. The simplest and most accessible description of the cult pattern that I've come across appears in sociologist Janja Lalik's book, Take Back Your Life. Why or under what circumstances do most people leave Zendik? Many people who leave Zendik get kicked out. Committed members who leave on their own accord often do so after enduring a long period of intense input or criticism. They reach an extreme of physical and mental exhaustion that makes it impossible to continue. I thought cults did their best to keep people in. Why would Zendik want to get rid of its members? It is in fact common for cults to kick out members who have become liabilities. Cult leaders want to exploit their followers' youthful energy and enthusiasm. They do not want to support them through the hard times or nurse them through illness, injury, or old age. Errol identified me as a liability and had me dismissed after a string of very bad selling days. One long-term member was asked to leave when the father of her child threatened to expose Zendik's wrongdoings in a custody lawsuit. Another member was told he ought to take a vacation after he'd been lying sick in the basement, unattended, for days. Also, Errol keeps people at Zendik not through force, but fear. She leads them to believe that they have no alternatives. If they leave, they'll never have a real friend, or do work that they enjoy, or make great art, contribute to their culture, and in short, they'll be miserable. Periodic purges serves to reinforce the loyalty of those that remain. It reminds those who are still there that they better redouble their efforts to please her, if they don't want to be next, if they don't want to be cast out into the death culture. So now, moving on to work. So when your average Zendik isn't out selling, what's she or he doing all day? Working, cooking, cleaning, building, tending animals, cutting firewood, tending to the garden, silk screening t-shirts, folding t-shirts, ordering food, running errands, and so on. You work from the time you wake up, which is not up to you, till the time you go to sleep, also not up to you. Unless you're in a meeting, getting or giving input, having sex, exercising, or eating. Do people get to choose what work they do? Sometimes, however, if you too consistently work in any one area and or display a penchant for innovation, independent thought in that area, you're likely to be pulled out of it on the grounds that you're getting ego-jacked or running your own show. What if I arrive at the farm with skills in certain areas? Am I likely to be able to apply those skills? Possibly, but it's more likely that you'll be told that all you've learned in the death culture is corrupt, and that if you'd like to work in your area of expertise, you'll need to start from scratch. For example, you'll need to apprentice to the Zendik way of doing things. And that is Helen Zuman's 2008 FAQ about Zendik Arts Farm. Her website is helenzuman.com. HelenZuman.com, and you can subscribe to her website and get extra information. One little treat that came to my email was this. Now, this is Helen reading excerpts of her book, Mating in Captivity.
Prologue. I spent most of my 20s trapped in a story. Here it is. You, all of you, belong to the death culture. You wake up, paste on fake smiles, scurry off to work, for your corporate master is raping the earth. You hate this, but you're stuck. You need the cash. For what? McMansions, gadgets, drugs, substitutes for love. I belong to Zendik. We're starting a revolution. We live on a farm and do lots of art. We work together, support each other, tell the truth. You've got to follow our lead if we're going to save the earth. I know, it's hard. Out there, you don't dare get straight, even with your mate. You might lose your shield, your one ally in your fight to survive. Real love takes a tribe, led by the first couple in history to do away with lies. I'll never leave Zendik. If I did, I'd die, in soul, if not in body. And I'd despise myself for betraying all life. In other words, I joined a cult. The year was 1999. I was 22. But I didn't say I joined a cult till 2005, more than 6 years later. No one knowingly joins a cult, and no one in a cult would call it that. We join, we commit to communes, new religions, personal growth programs, temples, revolutions. Saying I joined a cult comes later, if ever. It means releasing stories we doubt we can live without. Stories that give us purpose. Stories we can't see as stories, so long as they absorb us. When I left Zendik in 2004, I took its trap with me. I was doomed, I thought, unless I returned. What finally freed me was the only thing that ever frees anyone from mytho-captivity. A more compelling story. An excerpt from Chapter 1, Interview. My task after lunch was to help Zeta, one of the young women from the trenching crew, paint shelving units on the addition's upper level, divided into three bedrooms. The one we set up in was a loft at the crest of a spiral staircase, bright with sunshine pouring in through windows and skylights. From the railing, I admired the structure's soaring floor-to-roof sweep, as well as the love glowing through each hand-grafted detail. I would not have guessed that every board in the building had been pried from the skeleton of some rotting home or shop. The Zendiks had taken a motley jumble of derelict stuff and found purpose for it in a smooth new hole. Zeta filled two yogurt containers with thick white paint from a bucket nested in newspaper. As we laid it in sleek glides over rough reclaimed pine, I learned that she, like me, had grown up in New York City. She'd even attended the same high school as my sister at about the same time. A musical virtuoso, she played violin and sometimes sang backup in the all-improv Zendik band. She met her machismo quotient with high-topped combat boots and tiny-toothed shells biting into her dreadlocks. At the farm about a year and a half, she was one of only two black women in the group and one of only three black Zendiks. Warmed by news of our shared origins, I barely blinked when Zeta switched subjects. "Hey," she said with a playful smile, "has anyone told you how dating works?" "No," I said, "but last night at dinner I heard one of the girls say she was going on a date. I figured she and her boyfriend were heading into Hendersonville to see a movie or something." Watching Zeta's smile widen, I began to doubt the story I'd supplied. Was I wrong? Zeta laughed and nodded, eliciting a burst of clicks from the tiny teeth. "Yeah, you were wrong," she said. "Dating here is nothing like dating out there. The way we do it is totally different." She paused, raised her brush to remove a stray bristle. "Have you met Shore and Loria?" I hadn't. "They're the dating straighters. They've been here forever, I think since Boulevard." Straighter, I would discover, was Zendik slang for administrator. Boulevard, a town outside San Diego, was one of the farm's earlier locations. Other Zendik vintages, from older to newer, included Topanga, Texas, and Florida. In its 30-year history, the farm had moved many times. I nodded. Zeta continued. "If you want to get together with a guy you like, you ask one of them to hit him up for you. You can hit him up for a date, which means sex, or if you just want to kiss, hold hands, make out, you can start with a walk instead." My brush slowed as I imagined ambling through a meadow at midnight, hand in hand with Estero. The thought of my fingers twined in his roused a delicious wave of tingles. "You can say in advance how far you want to go, and the guy will respect that. No games, no pressure, no dumb pickup lines." My vision dissolved into the final scene of a vivid dream I'd had when I was 10. A handsome man, at least thrice my age, was chasing me through a tropical forest. Upon catching me, he said, "Let's not have sex. Let's just make love." I was relieved and enraptured. 12 years later, I still thought making love and having sex were separate things. To me, making love meant luxuriating in the holding and kissing, the stroking and petting, the languor and longing as long as you chose. This, it seemed, was the promise of a walk. Zeta broke in with the question. "You're a virgin, right?" "Yeah," I said, taken aback. "How'd you know?" "Oh," she said, dabbing extra paint into a knothole. "Toba told me, at lunch." She covered the patch around the knothole with short, quick strokes. "So yeah, you'd want to take it slow. Here you can do that. People will help." I thought again of Estero, the latest in a string of crushes threading back to first grade. How many boys, then men, had enthralled me with their wit, their salt, their sweat, only to dance out of reach? How many chances had I missed to take a hand, test for a match? Where had Zendik been all my life? "Wow," I breathed, gazing out the bedroom window at a pillow of mist falling on the Blue Ridge. "That sounds like a fairy tale." An excerpt from Chapter 2, Moving In. My plan, when I'd boarded the bus to North Carolina in late October, had been to give Zendik 2 weeks. If I didn't like it, I'd hitchhike 50 miles west, through squat peaks and deep gaps to the Appalachian Trail. I'd pick it up just east of the Tennessee border and march south toward Georgia. By the second week in November, the wild persimmon trees at the top of the driveway were shedding their leaves. Each day, fewer fruits hit the ground in sweet vermilion gooseblats. At night, a chill seeped through the seams in the plywood box's fur of pink fiberglass. Striking out for Georgia was swiftly losing appeal. Scrunched inside my mummy bag one evening, only my eyes exposed, I caught hold of a question that always seemed to dart away from me in the bustle of the day. Will I stay? Peering into the future, I glimpsed daunting decisions. My income tax return, which the grant would oblige me to file for the first time, was due in April. Complying, in my view, meant shoving meat down the maw of the U.S. war monster. I'd long admired Dorothy Day and the Catholic workers, who resisted war taxes by living in open-handed poverty, caring for anyone who showed up at a house of hospitality. Back in late summer, I'd stopped into an IRS office to ask whether I'd still need to pay tax on the grant money if I gave it to charity. The answer was no. Surrendering my $300 apprentice fee to the Zendiks shortly after learning how dating worked, I'd been glad to pass part of my windfall on to what seemed like a worthy cause. More pressing than taxes were my $16,500 in student loans, part of the hefty financial aid package that had allowed me to attend a school whose yearly tuition rivaled my family's annual income. The loans would enter repayment and begin accruing interest on New Year's Day. I'd owe about $100 per month for the first 5 years, then about $250 per month for the next 10. I hadn't been thinking about how I'd pay the money back when I'd signed my first promissory note on autopilot at 17. During college, I dispelled debt-induced anxiety with the failsafe of bankruptcy, still an option until Congress nixed it in 1998. Yes, going bankrupt would have ruined my credit, but the threat seemed abstract in a family where no one owned a house or a car or used a credit card. 5 months after graduation, I faced not just debt, but expectation that I would get a job with a regular paycheck and send a chunk of that paycheck to the Department of Education's Direct Loan Processing Center every month till I was 38. That I would embrace this arrangement out of gratitude for the nice salaries and professional opportunities made possible by my degree from Harvard. I hadn't known at 17 that I was signing up for selective service in the extractive economy, or that 5 years later I'd be handed a draft card. No, thank you, I thought, squeezing my eyes shut. Since entering preschool at the age of 3, I'd been hewing to a preset storyline. I was ready, wasn't I, to start my own story. In a journal entry dated Halloween, I'd written, "Idea, give all my money to Zendik, so the government can't get it. Write a letter to the Department of Education saying, this is my contribution to the education of the children of the future." The Zendik Farm Arts Foundation was registered with the IRS as a 501c3 organization devoted to teaching farm and life, work skills in animal husbandry, horticulture, and trades, including carpentry, mechanics, publishing, and music, arts, and crafts. Recurring 2 weeks into my immersion in Zendik culture, the idea seemed less a lark than it had at first. Plus, I'd known since I was a kid what a thrill it could be to give money away. In fourth grade, during Lent, I'd stuffed every cent I had into the cardboard poor box each student at my Catholic elementary school received from a missionary group called the Propagation of the Faith. I didn't know what the money would do for the suffering children depicted on the box. I didn't even know what propagation meant. I just knew I felt cleansed and reckless, exhilarated by a shift I'd chosen to make. In high school, when a wealthy friend of my mother's slipped me a $100 bill to cover a $17 cab ride home to Brooklyn from the Upper East Side, I handed the $100 to the driver and told him to keep the change. In college, on occasion, I gave $20 bills to spare changers. My joy was complete in the moment of giving, which felt more like communion than receiving the host at Mass ever had. Owen, the newest of the new guys, was up reading in the bunk across from mine. I scrunched deeper into my mummy bag, covering even my eyes now, to conserve body heat and block out his flashlight. I longed to be snug among women, in a bunk in the farmhouse, the heat of crow's fire rising through the floorboards. Maybe a big donation would smooth my path toward the farm's heart. An excerpt from Chapter 3, Dim Chambers. Carol Merson met Wolf Zendik, formerly Lawrence Wolfing, in Los Angeles in 1962, when she was 23 and he was 42. She'd just landed a part in a new TV series. He was writing fiction and poetry and dreaming of a lifelong partnership based on complete honesty. In a square old society relationship, he wrote, you can't even get to know each other because the other person is so valuable as a possession, as a shield against the madness and the insanity of the death culture. Everything is a defense against a hateful society that is out to do you in. Enthralled by his vision and brilliance, and the promise of a life immersed in love and art, she ditched the acting job to be with him. She dropped the C from her first name and took the last name Wolf. The two began playing music at clubs and cafes in LA. Wolf, a seasoned performer, taught Errol to play along. But the gigs didn't pay much, so Errol took up exotic dancing to cover food and rent, even though the late nights left her with little time or verve for art. Seeing that plenty of other artists were also struggling to get by, they imagined convening a tribe to share the burden of survival, a supportive social matrix in which people could do work they cared about, own and meet their true needs, and join Wolf and Errol in their quest to be honest. By this time, they'd realized that they could achieve complete honesty as a couple only within a community that shared their ideal. Wolf's parents offered him and Errol the use of a ranch they owned in the high desert east of Los Angeles. They could do as they pleased with the place, as long as they maintained it and kept the taxes paid. In 1969, the pair relocated to the ranch and began to attract would-be communards from far and wide. They started growing their own food and formed a band that toured nearby colleges. Zendik Farm was born. Coming together as a tribe meant confronting the lust to possess others, especially as lovers. Possessive attitudes about sex, Wolf wrote, lead to jealousy, hostility, hate, violence, murder. And such attitudes were vestigial if, as Wolf and Errol did, you defined love as interest, which didn't have built-in limits. Just as you could be interested in multiple ideas or art forms, you could be interested in multiple people. In 2006, Swan, nearing 30, would offer this description of her parents' arrangement to a reporter from the Washington Post. I grew up very strangely. Mom and Dad, their relationship was sexually open from the beginning. They always had other lovers. I never remember them sleeping in the same bed. I grew up with Mom and Dad as Mom and Dad, and they were never together. That is, they were bound by a tie more advanced than monogamy, devotion to each other's evolution, the dauntless pursuit of truth, determination to create a cooperative, honest culture for Swan that would one day embrace all children. Their union, which lasted till Wolf's death in June 1999, was the nucleus of a relationship revolution that would heal humanity and the planet. It was the only example we had, the first instance in history of friendship unto love. If we followed it, we could help end the war between the sexes, wars among nations, the war on our precious web of life. We could hope to know enduring love, and we could expect to struggle long and hard. Wolf and Errol had fought their death culture conditioning for decades. An excerpt from Chapter 4, The Lore of the Ring. I stood at the center of the dance room, ringed by 60 other Zendiks, about to take my vow. Earlier that night, all of us had showered and exchanged work clothes for our version of finery. Slacks, button-down shirts, skirts and dresses, tunics and blouses. Silk and twill, velvet and satin. We'd been told to dress up in dark colors for our consecration as warriors. A racing pulse repelled the winter chill. It was December 31st, 1999, a few minutes to midnight. Most had already spoken. We would finish our ritual before the millennium turned, and then let Y2 chaos storm the death culture. We told our own stories. We kept our own time. Errol, up in the addition, watching the farm's three children, was the one adult who would not stand where I stood. I'd practiced the vow dozens of times aloud and countless times in silence, to make sure I'd perform it perfectly, despite my nerves. I took a deep breath and spoke the first of three parts. As a Zendik warrior, I place myself on the truth way and vow my life and loyalty to this revolution of conscience and consciousness. To my right was a small table laden with necklaces. Behind it stood Swan, mistress of ceremonies, and, to me, Cinderella perpetually at the ball. The dance room had been built for her. Here she practiced and sometimes led classes. Immaculately groomed and beautifully garbed, she seemed to travel in her own galaxy of rose scent and smooth sparkle. She had blue eyes and blonde curls kinked like coral. Though dark roots peeked out even then, it would take me years to realize that her hair, beneath its gold veneer, was brown like mine. Though just 6 months my senior and also a fire dragon by the Chinese calendar, Swan ranged ages ahead of me on the Zendik evolutionary scale. If she was a mammal, endowed with higher order thinking skills and milk for her young, then I was a protozoan, just growing used to my nucleus. Born to Errol and Wolf in June 1976, 7 years after they'd started the farm, she was the first child to know only cooperation and honesty, the first dancer, the first artist, to develop her genius unfettered. She had never, her creation myth held, suffered corruption by the death culture. No wonder I wished I could turn back the clock and sneak into Errol's womb next to her. That night, thanks to my roommates, I reflected a glint of Swan sparkle. Errol had lent me a pair of silver hoops set with violet rhinestones, the first earrings I'd worn in years, to complement the navy blouse and slim-fitting velvet jacket that Riven, a core apprentice, had pulled from her shelves. I clasped my hands behind my back, then dropped them to my sides. Staring straight ahead, I channeled the current of excitement in the room without meeting anyone's gaze. The ring of Zendik faded into a pulsing haze. 2 months earlier, I would have dismissed the vow as so much mumbo-jumbo. By now, I was practiced at casting vagueness as portent and bringing my own meaning. I saw myself stepping through a fiery eye into a sphere of pure surrender as I spoke the second part. I vow to become affirmative in all I find true about myself, my world, and the universe itself. Most Zendiks, including me, had a copy of The Affirmative Life, a paperback booklet of Wolf quotes, small enough to slip in a back pocket. Each page offered either a reminder of cosmic connection, I am the mortal manifestation of infinite mind, and I carry the great spirit within me, or a whippet of metaphysical life coaching. Dare to demand the impossible, and it becomes possible. Feel the glory of simply being alive. We treated it like an oracle, choosing a random page and trusting it to yield just the right insight. The source material for The Affirmative Life, Wolf's raps, talks, and writings on the subject, took a harsher tone than the sayings in the booklet. In a piece titled Affirmative Living, Wolf said, "When and if you should catch yourself in negative moods of any form, cease it instantly, for it is a virulent toxin and will surely sicken and kill you. No one gets away with anything in this life. No act of criminal negativity will go unpunished." But I still imagined that affirmative living would lead me toward ever greater well-being and understanding. I'd yet to be charged with criminal negativity, shocked by Zendik's emotional electric fence. To all Zendik warriors, I place myself by your side as a weapon in our righteous fight to victory. That was it. I'd recited each word just right. The haze resolved once again into a ring of Zendiks. How thrilled I was to join my fate with theirs. I turned to face Swan. From the heap, she plucked a necklace, an amulet strung on a slender rope of twined floss. Each amulet, hammered and soldered by two of the Zendik men, was identical. A copper Z in a brass circle. The circle Zs, unlike the wristbands, would mark us to outsiders, set us apart in our war for a beautiful world. Flushed with the heat of 60 beating hearts, I bent my head and stretched it forward. She looped the rope around my neck.
In 2013, the farm, known as the Wolf Song Ranch, was up for sale for $950,000. And at that time, according to Zillow, that was $600,000 more than it really should have been. I'm not sure exactly how much it actually sold for, but as October of 2021, it's owned by a construction company called Tex-Mex, which is set to build a bunch of houses. Around August or September, Tex-Mex bought it from a cattle ranching outfit. Now it's time. I am going to leave you with 30 minutes of Wolf Zendik speaking to the fellow Zendiks in the community. Everyone's experiences seem different, however, all true. So it's up to you, dear listeners, to have your opinions and let me know your thoughts on social media if you'd like. You can find me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod, Instagram at Reverie True Crime, as well as Facebook.com/Reverie True Crime. Now, this video I could only find on Facebook. If you search under videos for Wolf Zendik, you'll find the video is probably the first one, and you can watch it there for yourself if you'd like. Now, here we go.
It's absolutely essential that everyone become as proficient as possible with language, because while animals who don't have language think in pictures and images, you see, although I know that our pets and so forth begin to use language also as they identify their name and other animals' names and Errol's name, my name, and et cetera, et cetera. The beginning of using language, in other words, words, in their thinking also. But we have the highest consciousness. So we have the highest consciousness. We have the highest awareness of our innate saintliness, our innate godliness, the fact that we are evolutionary manifestations of evolution itself, basic principle of the universe. Everything is in expansion. I believe everything is in growth, you see. That's why the human species is now in the process of extincting itself, because it refuses to philosophically and religiously expand and grow, you see. In its cowardice, it clings to orthodoxy, it clings to religions that are so old that nobody knows who even started them, you know? We rocket to the moon, right? To outer space, build fabulous cities, tunnel under the earth. It's, you see, what human beings are doing in every aspect of their existence is cre-evolutionary. You see? The human being is a cre-evolutionary animal. Every advancement in technology is a cre-evolutionary advancement, expansion. You see? That's why it moves so fast. Because the intellect, you see, and all these creative energies are brought to this process. You see? Well, how we can make a better stove, better television, better building materials, blah blah blah. You see what I mean? I hope this is fascinating stuff. I know for some of you it is. And to the people that feel that they're above or beyond it, I don't know what to say. I and the Corps and a lot of people here, and a lot of people who are on their way here, believe that what we do here and what we offer here is the only shot on this planet, the only hope. see? But you have to understand that you can't have been destroyed so radically, conditioned so severely, that you can't understand, mutated so badly intellectually. That doesn't mean you don't have a lot of shine and a lot of gloss, and you don't know how to do this, and you don't know how to do that, and you don't know how to pose and act, and maybe even make money or get by or work the welfare system or whatever the fuck you know how to do. You see? None of these have anything to do with intelligence. Intelligence means that you care about life, that you care about your future, that you understand that what I'm saying is life or death, that this is war, that humanity has gone totally flat out fucking berserk, and it's been on this path since before history, and it's time it stopped. And I not only believe that I can stop it, I know I can stop it. Because I see people gathering constantly. And I see their faces open. And they're not sheep. They're not fucking followers. They're learning to think. They're learning to think. That's the only way. It's the only thing you've got. In all these areas, the reason mankind has prevailed is because of its ability to reason and to think. You see? And I'm saying that Cree evolution is happening. And if you don't bring the Cree evolution concept into your religious feelings, into your feelings of spirituality, you're dead. Human beings are already doing it. But their philosophies, social philosophies, religious philosophies, all their philosophies suck. Because they don't have any balls, they don't have any guts. Namby-pamby old fogies, you know? They want a seat in the university, you know? Cowards. No guts. Courage. Courage. That's what it takes to live. To be a Zendik, to achieve that is the epitome of personal courage. It takes guts. You gotta be a hero. You gotta be a heroine. Now the reason why it's impossible, one of the basic tenets of the religious philosophy of Cree evolution is living in the moment, being alive, spontaneous, alive in the moment. As I said earlier, in the instant, in the infinite instant, understanding that at that instant, if you can grasp that instant, if you can be alive in that instant, you've got it. You've got it. All the knowledge is right there, in this moment. You see? Everything you need. You have to walk the truth way to accomplish that. That means that any bullshit that you hear within yourself, or you hear externally coming at you, or you hear going by in the wind, you give it the finger. See? You say, fuck you, man. You know? Your whole world is full of shit. You know? It's predicated on one lie after another until the whole thing has become like one gigantic pile of shit. A lie. Understand? If you don't have enough intelligence to want out, then you're doomed. I don't expect everybody to understand everything I'm saying, but I expect you to have like enough anima survival instinct. You know what that is? You think you're a human being? That's the name we're given. We're animals. Our soul is an anima soul. We're animals. Very adept, very clever, very cunning animals. I'm saying that we have to become intelligent animals, cosmically intelligent. How do you live in the instant? How do you live in the moment? Your brain inevitably is asleep. The only part of your mental faculty that works constantly is the autonomous system. You know, the neurons are firing in all the time, sending signals and what's happening in the body, and the cerebral cortex is picking everything up and sending it back, and you're functioning. The heart keeps beating, liver keeps working, you know nothing about it, you know? And that's all that's working. The intellect is not working. What's his name used to say, everybody's asleep all the time? Gurdjieff, yeah. Poor old huckster. What a con man. He was really angry. But he was right, everybody's asleep. So how do you get awake? See, things happen in the instant, you see? Psychological things, physiological things happen in the instant. Psychic things happen in the instant, see? And your pineal brain, you see? It's trying to pick up all this psychic stuff, you see? Doop, 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 doop. You know, it's got its antenna out. And it's hearing everything, you see? But unless that's transmitted to your consciousness, mm-hmm. See? Unless you're conscious of it, then it's just withered away, pithered away in dreams. Daydreams and wistfulness and so forth, you see? And you say, what did that mean? Isn't that weird? We both thought this at the same time, you know? Isn't that uncanny? You know, it's happening like, whoa, all the time, see? How do you overcome that? Because you can't live in the instant unless you're psychically aware, you see? And how do you become psychically aware? First, you have to become psychologically aware, physically aware, you see? So you're walking around like a bunch of robots, you see? You're doing what you're told. Before you came here, it was, well, should I vote or shouldn't I vote? I don't know, I'll never vote. Should I break this law or that law? All these kind of hackneyed decisions that you had to make, you see? Because everybody was making them, and that's what everybody was talking about. It's really like the grand soap opera, because nothing is happening on these levels, on this philosophic, religious level that you need to live. In the moment. If you can see the moment and the instant as just a chain, you see? Time is comprised of moments. Time is comprised of instants. If you can't live in the instant, there is no next instant. There's only now. If you're going to live pre-evolutionary and you have to do that, then you have to live pre-evolutionary in the instant. Otherwise, you're just passing the buck, and pretty soon you're dead, and you pass the buck all your life. You have to learn how to be alive in the fucking moment. The religions tell you, orthodoxy tells you, well, you're going to die, and some priest will come and say it's okay, or you do this, or you do that, and if you pray right and everything, then you'll go to this place or that place, and everything will be fine. Bullshit. life. Life is what counts. Living is what counts. That's the religious act. To live a magnificent life, a glorious life. To live that. To have great health. Great friendships. Great philosophy. Great sex. All of it. You gotta be greedy. You gotta be hungry for it. Hungry. Alive. It's just whizzing by. The instants are... Phew. How do you get in there? You see the logic to it? See the logic? You can't live now. You know, it's like, I'll do it tomorrow. Tomorrow is now. You see? There's a process called internal monologue. You've all read about it, studied it. It's the most difficult thing to accomplish. Because the autonomous mental system is working. The heart's working, the thing, your id, your libido, everything is working, you see, on a very low level. You're functioning, you know. You're sniffing around after sex or after food or after this or after that or your ideas, you see. What you have to do to extricate yourself from this dilemma, this overpowering, depowering human dilemma, which is being asleep on your feet, asleep on your ass, asleep when you're having sex. You see? You have to be greedy, you have to want more. Can't we do this better? You see? There's nothing that bores me. Nothing that bores me like sex toys. You know, stick a vibrator up your ass, right? You know? And massage your clit with a vibrator. You know? All that says, you see? All that says is you can't, like, get into the moment. You can't get into the instant, you see? You see? You believe in growing old, see? You better learn to believe in growing old. If you live any kind of successful life, to die young is to have lived a failed life. It's inevitable. It's simple math. You see what I mean? If you live a successful life, you'll live a long time. You see? And if you live a long time, you'll find that everything gets better. All of your senses become sharper and sharper. You see? Everything tastes better. Everything feels better. It's not the other way around that the culture has told us. How do you do that? You got to learn to live in the moment. So you pile up these moments, you see, and you become like a profound human being, you see. Oh, you better listen, man. You're in deep trouble. Deep trouble. You're about to lose it. And you better listen. The way you do it is you revere your thinking process. You revere your thinking process. It's what makes you a human animal. It's what makes you the supreme animal. Probably the supreme animal in all the universe. Quite logically, you see? That means that you can accept your godliness. You see? You can accept your religious profundity. You see? That you are of great consequence, you see? You have to keep that in your brain all the time. And the way you do that is by an exercise of continually rapping to yourself, continually talking, the internal monologue. Now, the way you get into it is you begin, you learn to metatrance, and in metatrance you tell yourself that this is internal monologue unto internal dialogue. You learn that in metatrance. There's no other place to learn it. You keep your journal, you write, you get mentored, you see? But you have to learn it ultimately in metatrance, and then once you learn it in metatrance, you're in a trance state, and you carry that trance state up into your waking, walking life, and you stay in metatrance. And in metatrance, you train yourself, you teach yourself to think profoundly all the time. Develop an ear for the truth. You know you're on the truth where you hear bullshit. You hear your own bullshit. You hear your own bullshit in your internal monologue. You don't know whether the fuck you're telling the truth or not unless you listen to yourself. You've all been grumbling and griping and bitching and calling people names and everything to the back. You turn your back, you walk up. You see? You'll die that way. You've got to become alive intellectually. You have to train yourself too, because nobody taught you to do this but me. You see, I had to teach myself. I'm still teaching myself. I'm still a blunderer at it. You see what I mean? But I know, I've had enough experience to know how marvelous it is. You can get love that way. You can get love. People can. You can learn to be an object of love so that people will love you and respect you and care about you. You see? You don't have to be an old guru. You can be 18 years old and do it. You see? But the way you do it is by listening to your own stream of consciousness, your own mentality. You hear it working, you see? And you pick up, you're on the truth way, remember? That means you're into the truth. You know that the truth is your salvation. You want to build a bridge, you want to build a skyscraper, you want to go to the moon, you can only be built on truth, one truth after the other. That's the way physics works, you see? That's the way engineering works. That's the way things are accomplished in the pre-evolutionary world, on truth. The fact that engineers and scientists go home and beat their wives and get drunk and have horrible social problems has nothing to do with it. In that little area of their life where they're genius, they're pre-evolutionists. Now, all I'm asking you to do is to do that with your thinking process. If you're religious about that, about your mentality, about your thinking, you see? And you have to learn to do it. Eventually, pre-evolution, equilibrium will teach all the children how to do it, to be reflexive, you see? What generation, I don't know, but we have to go for it, you see? It's rudimentary, really. But just like so many things, it sounds like, oh, wow, do I have to do that, see? There's nothing more difficult. Mm-hmm. But what you have to do, and the way you get into it initially, you carry it up from your metatrance, you see? Mm-hmm. You keep yourself in a trance state all the time. That means that you're hip to yourself. You're on to yourself. You're aware of yourself. You're very self-conscious in a sublime way, you see? Mm-hmm. You're listening to all this stream of consciousness stuff, you see? And you're censoring it. Bam, 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 see? Getting rid of the bullshit. Bringing in truth. That's true. I love it. That worked. See, that worked. But you won't know that if you're asleep on your feet. And the way you become awake is intellectually. So, whenever there's a crisis, whenever you feel bored, you see? Whenever you feel like somebody's working out on you, you see? Whenever you feel oppressed, whenever there's any kind of like crisis in your life, if your life's threatened or whatever, you see, that's the time when if you really study and you really understand, you can begin to say, I better start thinking. I mean, she is laying shit on me, man. She's laying shit on me. She's working out on me. I can feel it. I know it. You know? Now, what the hell is going on? You have to start a dialogue with yourself. That means you have to learn to respect yourself, learn to respect your own mentality. You see, you have to become like a genius at this, see? And you know that any bullshit, any internal bullshit, any bullshit you hear that you don't reject, will kill you. You can only build your path on the truth way with truth after truth. If you let one lie and you accept the lie and try to step over it, you're going to stumble and you're going to fall off. And you're lucky if you can start over again. You see? So that's what you do. It's just simple. But like all great, profound things, they're built on simplicity. You see? All great art is always built on simplicity. You know? So you do that. You revere your thinking process, you revere your intellect, you revere your brain, and everybody else's too. You see? And you start all around the farm, you start saying to people, what are you thinking? You think you're sharp? You think you got it figured? Bullshit. You think you can beat that system? No. I thought I could beat it. All fools think they can beat it. They all. It's very interesting. Because you think I'm better than that. See, I can put it over on them. I can put it over on my parents. I can put it over on the teachers. I can put it over on the cops. I can put it over on the narcs. I can put it over on my girlfriend. I can put it over... You can't. You're putting it over on yourself. You can't afford to lie. You can't afford to cheat. You can't afford it. You can't afford to let anybody do it around you. You have to get in a culture that knows that, that forbids it. That's the path to heaven. It's the truth way. It's the only path. No priest is going to save you. Christ is not going to come down, you know, in a like a hang glider or something and say, you know, the cat couldn't make it past 32, man. You know? It was a loser. You see? It's all bullshit. The whole fucking South is the idiotic Bible Belt, you know? You're going to live. You're going to get anything out of life. I don't care to tell you about afterlife. What do you know about afterlife? Whatever afterlife there is based on the life you lived. I don't care how much money you pay, how much tithing you pay, how many preachers you listen to, you know? All your hypocrisy, everything pays off from day to day. Your life is a boring tedium. It's hell. You've got to get on the truth way. Cree evolution is the only way you can do it, kids. I'm telling you the truth. I love it. I love it. I love the truth way. I love it. Makes you want to get up in the morning. It makes you want to do something. It makes me want to write. It makes me want to play music. It makes, you know. Sometimes I look at myself, what am I doing? You know. You know, 75, I'll be 76 in a couple of months. I take up new instruments, you know. I start new projects. I mean, what arrogance. What conceit, you know. I used to read about little old ladies that were 80 years old and they were going to night school learning to type or something, you know, and I thought, what the fuck are they doing? They got to type for St. Peter or something, you know. But I understand their anima drive now that I didn't then, you see. You see what I mean? They just, the profound thing to do, of course, is to, with your age, with your life, with your youth, is to turn life into an art. You see? To live life as an art. And you have to, you can't do that in a culture that isn't artistic. You see? So you either have to form a culture of 2, of 10, or 20, build it just like we did, or join one that's built on premise of you have to live life as an art. And then when you see something in it, in this culture, here, now, at Zendik, that you don't think is arty, you don't think is artistic, you think is bullshit, then you're supposed to stand up and say that. You're supposed to write it out and send it to the authorities in triplicate. You're supposed to stand up and say, hey, you know, I want it to be right. If you don't want it to be right, then what are you living for? You think you're going to sneak by? Personally or in your culture, you can't sneak by. If you try to sneak by, you're a sneak, and a sneak is lost. You don't put anything over on anybody. You're always putting it over on yourself. You got to be divine. You got to be noble. You got to be grand. Life has to be glorious. It won't tolerate bullshit. It won't tolerate a lie. It won't tolerate smugness. It won't tolerate conceit. It won't tolerate that kind of vanity. It'll only tolerate sincerity and integrity and honest and nobility. That's all life will tolerate. Otherwise, you're dead. Thank you.